Back in August in 1999 in Britain, folks were heading to the southern tip of the UK to watch a total solar eclipse. Annoyingly, my family were on holiday in Ireland, where even in the south, we knew we were only going to get a partial solar eclipse. In the event, the weather was so cloudy and grey that we didn't even realise it had happened until it was over. So this week, while many of my delighted friends in America gawp as their world turned briefly dark, I watched from the sidelines again. Jealous not to be there, but somehow missing the eclipse by thousands of miles was much easier than missing by a couple of hundred. I'm Marnie Chesterton from the BBC World Service. This is Unexpected Elements. And totally eclipsing my heart this week is the Unexpected Elements Global Panel. In Mumbai, India, we have journalist Chavi Sachdev. Hello, Chavi.
Hello, salam.
And currently in Mexico, we have global health journalist Christine Johannes. Welcome, Christine.
Salam, salam, Marnie. Thank you.
Christine, Mexico was in the eclipse path, wasn't it? Did you see anything?
I did see the sun being eclipsed partially by the moon, and that was really interesting. What really caught my eye also was a Mayan show that they put in honor of the eclipse that I got to witness. So I was feeling all jittery about the whole thing.
Oh, that sounds great. Now, this is a science show with a difference. So we're all about the breaking news, but that usually isn't the latest scientific breakthrough. Instead, we're inspired by the rest of the news agenda, and we use our chosen subject as a starting point to dig around inside health, science and tech. So sure, the Americas faced an eclipse, but it's not the only phenomenon which left millions of us struggling to adjust for the blinding brilliance sprung upon us. There's also a new Beyoncé album out.
There's been widespread praise for an eagerly awaited new album by Beyoncé, which challenges preconceptions about country music.
It's a powerful statement that African-American artists can perform country too.
My grandfather was buried in his cowboy boots, so as a black woman from the South, it's intrinsic to my identity.
On the album's cover, Beyoncé portrays a rodeo queen in a cowboy hat and boots, and she's sitting on a horse holding the American flag.
Get it, girl!
Yes, the queen has done it again. And if you're thinking, wait, what's all this got to do with science? Have we got some unexpected elements coming up for you? Christine, what have you dug up?
Beyoncé's album is a testimony that people of color were and continue to be fundamental to the development of country and Western music. Cowboys and country go together like hands and gloves. And it's kind of like always shown cowboys as being white. So we're going to be looking into that idea or the image of what a cowboy is. Now, this study that I'm referring to was written by Nicholas Del Sol, an archaeozoologist at the Florida Museum of Natural History. They found cow bones that were 400 years old. And by analyzing the DNA of those bones, they found that different bones came from African cattle, which means that they were brought to the Americas at least a century earlier than historians thought. And it changes the whole perspective on the mythical figure of the cowboy, which has been whitewashed over the 20th century.
So archaeologists have come along and they've fact-checked.
Exactly. And so this new study shows that the cows arrived somewhere in the early 1600s, which could be tied to the slave trade, suggesting that herders and their cattle might have come as some sort of a package.
So, Christine, before this new piece of research, where did we think the cows came from?
It was believed that the first cattle that reached the Americas had come from Spain and that they were brought by Christopher Columbus to the island of Hispaniola, probably around 1493. And modern American cattle are a mix of European and African breeds. So researchers thought that the African contribution had come via Spain or from cattle imported in the 19th century. But they found cow bones that were being held in a museum. And analyzing the DNA of those bones shows that there's good evidence that a strongly African genetic marker shows up really early on.
I wonder if there's a difference between how cows from Spain and Africa adapted to their new homes.
In Del Sol's paper, he suggests that colonizers may have been trying to adapt herds to tropical conditions in the Caribbean and Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula. And he continues to say, ranchers needed trained skill workers, and African ranchers were more knowledgeable about raising cattle in tropical environments. So in terms of like the first cowboys being Black, records show that innovations like herding cattle from horseback appeared first in the Americas at a time when most cowboys were enslaved Africans and only spreading to Europe later.
I'm swinging an imaginary lasso as you talk, Christine. Thank you for the archaeologically accurate origins of cowboys. And all of this talk of country music, which of course started this whole chat, it seems to have got under the Unexpected Elements team's skin.
Alex, what the heck is that racket? Some of us are trying to work here.
How dare you? I'm trying to come up with a new country version of the Unexpected theme tune. You'll be humming this in your sleep in a few weeks' time.
Whose idea was that? There's nothing wrong with the theme tune you have now.
Well, I was thinking about the cover versions in Beyoncé's new album, like that new version of Jolene. And it got me thinking of how music history is really the history of cover versions and tributes and interpretations. And a little refresh is always welcome.
But a new composition is surely a new composition. There is such a thing as originality, not to mention skill. In music?
No, I don't think there is deep down. Ethnomusicologists think that all music goes back to something prehistoric, when someone heard the first singing or drumming, and they started doing the same thing but slightly changed it, and then somebody else added their bit, and so on down the generations.
But what about different instruments, different tunings, different traditions around the world? It's not all about Western octaves, structures and rules.
Ah, but it's much like the evolutionary history and taxonomy of scorpions compared to crabs. Both have lots of legs and a pair of claws, but any common ancestor was so long ago, we can't tell what it was. And scorpions are more like a hard rock version of a spider, whereas a crab turned out as a slightly edgy version of a prawn. But they're both just trying to eat, fight, mate, and reproduce.
Okay, I take your point about convergent evolution. But I don't think any copyright lawyer will ever accuse you of musical plagiarism.
The right notes, not necessarily in the right order. I don't know what that was, but it ain't country. Thanks to Margaret, and keep at it, Alex. Maybe just don't do it in the open plan office.
Speaking of country music, you know that distinctive twang? Some of it has to do with the particular instrument they're using, a mainstay of country and bluegrass. Any guesses which instrument?
I know that the instruments most associated with bluegrass and folk music are the banjo and the fiddle. And because you've said twang, I'll have to say you're probably referring to the banjo.
Absolutely correct. It's that classic country sound.
That.
It's a sound that brings to mind images of 19th century America, newly founded, rough. The banjo seems to have so much history.
It's older than America itself, but let's keep in mind that America isn't very old. The oldest surviving banjo, well, they can trace it to slaves who brought it from Africa to America at least by 1620. And it's based on a traditional African gourd instrument called the akonting. But I'm guessing it's got a much longer history because every culture in the whole world seems to have people who used dried up bodies of pumpkins and squashes, vegetables we call gourds, to make instruments.
That's the best use of a squash, in my humble opinion.
Oh.
I could eat it or I could dry it out and turn it into a musical instrument.
I personally love all kinds of squashes. But in India, you know, we have so many instruments based on this. The veena, the sitar, the tanpura, there are several more. But now listen to a six-string guitar. Enter banjo. or not, the banjo's metallic sound has had acoustic experts scratching their heads for a really long time. But now, thanks to Nobel Prize-winning physicist David Pollitzer, Cambridge University professor Jim Woodhouse, and acoustic specialist Hossein Mansour, we've got a better idea of why it has its characteristic ring.
Finally, we've got some banjo scientists on Unexpected Elements.
Okay, lesson one. In all acoustic string instruments, plucking or strumming the strings makes the section that's under the strings vibrate. That section is called the soundboard. The soundboard vibrations disturb the surrounding air, and that turns into the sound we hear. With a sitar or a guitar, the soundboard is made of wood, but on a banjo, it's like a tambourine or a drum with a stretched membrane, and it's often called a skin, which makes this soundboard lighter than a guitar's. And the banjo's neck, where the strings run along, is also lighter.
I'm curious, Tavi, what effect does that have on the sound?
So the different soundboard makes the bridge vibrate as well. And then the tension of the string changes twice. So once from the initial pluck, and then again from the resulting motion of the bridge. And this change is what gives this banjo its bright, twangy sound.
I loved it when you described it as metallic. That's exactly it. It's this twang.
Right. No, well, let's go for lesson two. Things are going to get a little more jargony, and bear with me. So the team that studied it demonstrated that the sound is being influenced by what are called formants. Let me explain it through the example of singing. If you sing a steady note, there are two choices you have, right? You can hold the pitch of the note, or you can choose a vowel sound that you want the listener to hear. So when you do vowels, they're less punchy than oohs.
So what we're learning, and this is something that we could pass on to Beyoncé, is that ooh grabs your attention more than ah. This is science, people.
It's very important science, yes.
Yeah, back to the banjo.
So back to the banjo, because of the shape and materials of the banjo, its formants are punchier, and they stick out more in the sound mix. They grab your attention in a way that other instruments don't. They're the oohs compared with the other ahs.
We love it when our listeners get in touch. So if you have a music missive or any comment to share, you can contact the show on unexpected@bbc.co.uk or WhatsApp us on +44 330 678 3080. You can also write to us at Unexpected Elements, BBC World Service, Cardiff, CF10 4GA in the UK. Still to come, the Professor of Music, but not in the way you might think. That's coming up after this. Welcome to the Unexpected Elements quiz, and this week we're irritating your brain cells with a spicy question. Chili peppers contain a chemical called capsaicin, which produces the sensation of burning in most species, apart from birds, who don't have receptors for this substance. The strategy was that birds spread the chili's seeds and other animals avoid eating it. Only humans ruined this with our desire to feel this weird sensation. Chemist Wilbur Scoville invented the Scoville scale to give units to the hotness of the sensation in your mouth. But what is the hottest measured chili pepper? Is it A, Pepper X, B, the Carolina Reaper, or C, the Trinidad Scorpion? Get your guesses in and stay tuned to find out if you're right. Now, back to the show. You're listening to Unexpected Elements from the BBC World Service, where we've been searching for the science behind Beyoncé's new country album. Now, I'm very excited to welcome a professor who, dressed in a tie-dye rainbow lab coat, dances and sings, hoping to change perceptions about who can be a scientist and what scientists can be like. You might know him for his social media account at DrDre4000 and his recent TikTok to Beyoncé's Texas Hold'em. Welcome to the show, Professor Andre Isaacs.
Thank you for having me. It's an honour to be here.
I mean, if we're doing Beyonce, we had to get in contact with you.
You know, we've done a few videos to Beyonce tracks before, so I guess we're building up quite the repertoire of Beyonce content.
And what do you do? What's your title?
Yeah, so I'm an associate professor of chemistry at the College of the Holy Cross. It's in Worcester, Massachusetts, and it's a liberal arts college. So I teach undergraduates in organic chemistry.
And you also make these wonderful videos. So can you paint a... I know, radio's not great for describing TikTok videos, but maybe you can. Maybe the one in which you did chemistry super bases?
Yes. So what I try to do is to make videos to excite students about learning. So the super base video actually was my attempt to really use music as a way to educate about chemistry. What I noticed, you know, was Nicki Minaj's album came out, I think, in December. And within a few days, all the students knew the lyrics to the songs, right? So I thought maybe, you know, we need to be better at educating and maybe we can write lyrics to these popular songs and change the lyrics, you know, to science and maybe students will learn it better.
Because there is an awful lot of learning to remember in chemistry. You need to know what mixes with what in what conditions. So you're saying if you have that as a various songs from Beyonce or Nicki Minaj in your head, then it's just there at your fingertips.
Exactly. You just have to change the words and then it's so accessible and it works.
Now, we're going to play one. First, a quick explanation of the chemistry. Can you explain what snatching protons for life means?
Oh, yes. So snatching protons, as I should translate into chemistry terms, really is equivalent to an acid-base reaction, right? So we have a base that reacts with an acid, and how the reaction between the two happens is the base grabs a hydrogen atom from the acid, and that hydrogen transfer is the result of that reaction. So it's something students have to think about. They need to know what hydrogen to snatch and what base will snatch what hydrogen. And so it's a very important skill to have as a chemist.
I wish that I could snatch these protons for life. For life. Barb, same school. LD is snatches from the abundant side. That side, that side. Kinetic e-knowledge she make every time. Every time.
Y'all things you don't know.
Hey, for thermodynamic you should use hydroxide. Hydroxide. Hydroxide.
It's all about the base.
Yes, this is actually a tricky concept for students, right? So the song is really explaining what base do you use when you wanted a thermodynamic or the kinetic product. And students often struggle to remember which one to use in what scenario. And so, you know, I made these lyrics explaining when to use which base. And a bunch of students have said, you know what? These lyrics are catchy. I think I'll be able to remember it now. So
where were you when I was doing my chemistry exams? You also, Andre, have a lot of these amazing choreographed dance routines in your lab, like the one for Beyoncé's Texas Hold'em. So when you make these videos, what is it that you want to show the world?
I want to show the world that the perception is, you know, as a scientist, you have to be boring, you have to be hidden away in a dark lab, you can't show any personality, right? There's some norms around STEM disciplines that, you know, you need to be impersonal. And I think I want to flip that. I think, you know, bringing to bear your authentic self and who you are as a person is only going to make science better. When, you know, and so I want all my students and everyone who's doing science to recognize that there is value in what they bring to the table. And you can also fuse your scientific learning with your interests, and that's going to make it even better. So my students are more excited to work in the lab or to learn science when they get to do things they enjoy as well, right? Like doing choreographed dances, which surprisingly, a bunch of my chemistry students are really good at dancing.
There's a phenomenon, I don't know if it's still going, but it was called Dance Your PhD.
And yes.
Have you come across that?
I have, yes.
It's such a good idea, because even if your PhD is something sort of massively incomprehensible, that the fact that you've suddenly got to communicate it and you're not allowed any words just opens it up for different ways of interpreting it.
I agree. And I think it also makes it more accessible for lay folks, right? So if you're...
Everyone's family, yeah.
Exactly. If you're able to explain it through dance, my God, I think you can explain it to anyone.
Can I ask about you? When did you get into science?
I got into it in high school, believe it or not. And I think I was fortunate. My uncle went to medical school and decided he wanted to be an educator in Jamaica, back in Jamaica, where I grew up in Kingston. And he dropped out of medical school, started an evening continuing education school for adults. And I was struggling with chemistry in high school. And he said, come to my evening school and let me help you. And he just had a brilliant way of explaining chemistry. And I just fell in love with the analogies he made, you know, talking about bonding in terms of relationships, you know, using religion as a way to explain chemistry. It was just really clever. And so I just fell in love with it. And ever since then, I wanted to pursue chemistry. I went to college and it just went on from there.
How far up the chemistry ladder did you get before you thought, I'm going to start singing and dancing? Because it's not your classic chemistry trope.
It's definitely not. And it was really during my tenure as a professor just a few years ago that I started doing that. And it was definitely because of my students, right? Oftentimes we educate in the ways we were educated. And over the past few years, I've been learning from my students about how they want to be educated and the type of environment they would like to learn in. And so a bunch of my students were always suggesting we should do this choreography, we should do this dance, and have embraced it since.
So basically putting some fun back into the science.
Yes. Bring fun into science.
Who would have thought? I mean, it's groundbreaking. Oh, thank you so much, Professor Andre Isaacs. Now, listen, talking of work, we haven't actually talked about your work at all. We've talked about TikTok videos. So if it's all right with you, we're going to come back to you in the second half of the show and talk a bit about the actual chemistry. How do you feel about that?
Let's do it.
So after a bit of a song and dance and inspired by Beyoncé's new album, we've discovered that early cowboys were black or Mexican, that the iconic instrument of bluegrass, the banjo, was originally an African instrument cased on a gourd, and Professor Andre Isaacs just shared why he thinks chemistry deserves a bit of the old razzle-dazzle. Well, don't we all? A month ago, I was reading this study that said that dancing is even more effective than medication at treating depression. So whatever gets your toes tapping is worth a listen. Still to come on the show, chemistry that's a bit like Lego or Legos. We explore whether the Earth is shrinking. There'll be insights into why some hair is curly. And I'll be telling the story of how an eclipse just over 100 years ago helped overturn a world of physics, putting Einstein's theory of relativity on its throne. That's all coming up shortly. This is Unexpected Elements from the BBC World Service. I'm Marnie Chesterton in Wales in the UK, and with me in voice are our global panel of journalists. In India we have...
Chavi Sachdev.
And in Mexico we have...
Christine Johannes.
And still with us we also have Andre. Andre, if you'd like to remind listeners what you do.
Hi, I'm Andre Isaacs. I'm an Associate Professor of Chemistry at the College of the Holy Cross in Worcester, Massachusetts.
And we'll be hearing about Andre's adventures in click chemistry in a moment. But first, every week, Chavi, Christine and I sort through a lot of stories looking for places where the science shines through. We call this section Under the Radar. Chavi, you're starting us off. What's been going on in your world that you think should be getting more attention?
A story of a quiet little rebellion. OK, maybe that's a little more sensationalist than the actual truth, but see what you think. But first, what do you know about how species are named?
I know a bit about how some of them have slightly silly names. So gorilla, gorilla, gorilla is the official name for a gorilla. Mm-hmm. Oh, there's Latin involved as well.
Absolutely. Full points to you there. Yes, there are rules in taxonomy, which is the finding, describing and naming of the species of living or fossil organisms. We use what's called a binomial nomenclature, which means there are two parts to the name. So think of Homo sapiens or Tyrannosaurus rex. The first part of the name, the generic name, usually Latin, identifies the genus to which the species belongs. But the second part is the species within the genus. And the system started back in 1622 with Gaspard Bauhin, and it was formalized in 1753 by Carl Linnaeus in his book Species Planetarum. By the way, should you find an undiscovered species, either of you, it's considered bad taste to name it after yourself, and it's one of the rules set by the International Code of Zoological Nomenclature. Besides that, the name must be unique. It has to be a combination of genus name and species name, but not one that already exists for any other animal. And finally, the name can't be rude. The ICZN states that no name should give offence on any grounds.
Who decides that, though? Because Linnaeus wasn't above using his power as the scientist who named most things to name, I think it was a toad and a stinky weed after a guy that he didn't like.
Well, you can always debate whether naming a horsefly Scaptia beyoncea is a tribute or an insult.
Oh, wow.
Wait, horsefly? Beyoncea?
Well, actually, in India, there is a movement afoot to move away from Latin hegemony and celebrities. So there is no rule about using Latin. And what we're doing now is trying to make taxonomy inclusive of the culture, communities and characteristics of places, for example, where the species are found. So, for example, a scientist in the hills of India's Western Ghats called Gururaja KV, he's discovered 23 species of frogs, and one of them, for example, covers its eggs with mud to hide them from predators. So since the local term for a potter where this frog was found is Kumbhara, this muddy little chap has been named night frog Nyctibatricus Kumbhara. So he was like, why not try to also use indigenous knowledge and language and involve locals in conservation? So when Ramaswamy SRK discovered a new butterfly species in December 2023 in the Meghamalai Hills, he christened it the Sigaritis meghamalainis, after its location. And the Tamil word, Meghamalai, means subtropical evergreen forest, which we also call the cloud forests. And these are the ones that are found in the higher altitudes.
So listen, we're all Homo sapiens here. But Chavi, if you could name yourself this way, what would you call yourself?
So I don't know if I would change it very much. My name has a meaning because I'm Indian and most of our names evoke something. So it's Chavi is a poetic way of saying image or picture. And my last name is Sachdev, which if you break it down is little god of truth. So that truth part I like because I'm a journalist and a storyteller. But Chavi maybe should have been something that works with audio instead of pictures because I don't do anything with TV or film, right? Just radio and podcasts.
Christine?
I'm happy to be called Mundus Chrysos Luxanto. And because Mundus, which means world, describes my refusal to be tied to any one place and, you know, of my effective belonging to the entire world. Chrysos means gold because I believe that I am. And it sounds like Chris, which is what my brother calls me. Lux means light. Xanto means yellow because it's my favorite color. So I'd be Mundus Chrysos Luxanto.
It's got a good medieval ring to it as well. Andre, if you're playing, have you got a name according to this new nomenclature?
I guess I would, you know, if I had to really think about it from a chemistry perspective, I guess I would say, you know, I like thinking about configuration of chirality. So I'm going to go with Rectus for the R configuration. Rectus Andre.
Andre the right.
Yes, exactly.
This is a point where I want to bring our listeners in. If anyone has a taxonomic name for themselves, then we'd like to hear it. Emails to unexpected@bbc.co.uk. Coming back to you, Professor Andre Isaacs, or should I say Rectus Andre from the College of the Holy Cross in Massachusetts. We've talked about your dance moves. We haven't actually talked about your field of research, organic chemistry. So let's start with the basics. What's that?
Yeah, organic chemistry, the revered subject, I would like to say, or the most challenging subject in colleges, according to many students, but it really just covers carbon-based molecules, right? So carbon is really the building block of life. So anything involving carbon is really what we study. How to make carbon-carbon bonds, carbon-hydrogen bonds, carbon-halogen bonds, and build in molecules like people build cars.
So that's organic chemistry. Within that field, Andre, you work on something called click chemistry, which has been described as being like molecular Lego, or Legos, if you're American, which makes it sound like child's play. Is it?
I mean, I guess it is a form of child's play. So click chemistry is really just a concept, right? So if you think about how nature makes molecules, nature builds really complex systems and molecules really through the combination of very small library of other building blocks, if you think of molecules as building blocks. And the way we make molecules in chemistry is oftentimes not as simple or as elegant. And so Barry Sharpless came up with this idea that maybe we should try to imitate nature in a way by developing reactions that are kind of modular, right? You can take smaller building blocks and just click them together like Legos and have something that is fairly complex in a very simple transformation. And so that birthed the idea of click chemistry as a concept. But it really is one particular reaction that has kind of elevated itself in our eyes as the premier click reaction. And that reaction is the combination or the clicking of two Lego coupling partners, an alkyne and an azide. And you use copper to facilitate that reaction. And what that does is it takes those two specific types of molecules and brings them together to make what we call a triazole. And that's just a five-membered ring of atoms that has three nitrogens and two carbons in that ring. And it is a powerful system that is found across all of science. People have used that particular system in agriculture, in drug development, in material sciences. And Caroline Bertozzi won the Nobel Prize in 2022, along with Sharpless and Meldel, for using this reaction to study what's happening in a cell. And so this chemistry is really, really clever. But for my lab, we actually use it a little bit differently. What we do is we actually manipulate the product of the click reaction to making other ring systems that also have nitrogen atoms in them. And some of these ring systems are also found in a lot of pharmaceutical drugs that actually are overrepresented with these nitrogen ring systems that we try to make. So basically, the goal is to use this chemistry to aid in the, you know, the pharmaceutical industry's efforts to making affordable drugs.
Andre, before I say goodbye, can I just get back to your TikToks and ask you?
Oh, please.
Are you choreographing a dance routine currently?
Oh, my God. So there are quite a few dance routines that are being choreographed. And of course, some tracks on a new Beyoncé album that, you know, we think we could find some chemistry connections to that we're working on. So, yeah, we have our hands full.
Andre Isaacs, thank you so much for sharing with us. And, you know, people come for the Beyoncé and they stay for the chemistry.
Thank you.
We always leave space for your letters and texts. And in last week's show, Colin got in touch with a question about why our hair grows the way it does. And it triggered more questions about the variety of hair types out there, which got me thinking about an edition of the World Service programme Crowd Science that I presented all about hair. I spoke to the wonderful Dr. Tini Lasisi at Penn State University, who told me that tightly curled hair could have been an important adaptation for human evolution. Tina did experiments to see if human hair really does help protect our brains from overheating. To do this, she needed help from Loughborough University in the UK.
They used this really creepy android called a thermal mannequin, and you basically can put clothes on it, or if you're me, you put a wig on it, and you basically measure how that is affecting its ability to lose and gain heat.
So Tina added an afro and straight hair wigs to these cyborgs and measured how much solar radiation was getting down to the mannequin's scalp. And she found a huge difference.
Let me tell you, I was shocked. What we found is that if you have tightly curled hair, that hair is able to protect you and that radiation doesn't travel all the way down to your scalp. And then you have straight hair, which puts you at a better spot than having no hair at all because it offers some protection. But at the same time, because straight hair fibers are all lined up, you know, so neatly packed next to each other, it also ends up insulating your head so you can't lose heat as efficiently as you can if you had this curly structure that has all of these air pockets.
It's constantly amazing to me that evolution has come up with all these neat adaptations.
The difference between how straight hair actually retains heat, so it's perfect for winter, and the curlier hair allows for cooling, which is perfect for tropical weathers. That was really mind-blowing. I couldn't be prouder now more than ever, knowing that there's a reason why I have evolved in this way.
Still to come, how an eclipse helped out Einstein's theory. After this. Welcome back to the Unexpected Elements quiz. Earlier on in the show, I asked about the hottest chili pepper on the Scoville scale, a scale developed to measure capsaicin, the chemical in chili peppers that produces a heat-like sensation. I asked, was it A, pepper X, B, the Carolina Reaper, or C, the Trinidad Scorpion? All three are peppers hot enough to make you cry, but well done if you said A, pepper X. It was recently bred by Ed Curry to steal his own title from the Carolina Reaper peppers he also breeds, which used to top the Scoville scale with 2.2 million heat units. For comparison, that's 800 times hotter than a jalapeno. Pepper X averages 2.6 million Scoville heat units, and if anyone has tried one, please email unexpected@bbc.co.uk and let us know how it went. In amongst the emails and texts from you, sometimes there's a question to challenge the detective powers of the Unexpected Elements team. Cue music. Yes, it's time for Ask the Unexpected, and this week we've had a question from Gerald.
Hello. My name is Gerald Munduga, a creative artist from West Nile. That is a region in northwestern Uganda. I'm a big fan of Unexpected Elements, thanks to Manny, who is doing a fabulous job over there. Well, I have this question that keeps popping up into my mind. Is the Earth shrinking? Think about humans digging and mining to build skyscrapers, dams, and other mega construction projects.
Thank you, Gerald. That's a really interesting question. So, if we're taking stuff out of the Earth, is the Earth shrinking? Well, we've done exactly what you would expect and found someone who knows the answer. Here's David Rothery, Professor of Planetary Geosciences at the Open University.
This is an interesting question. When raw materials are mined or quarried, we take stuff from the Earth's crust and pile it up on top. But in the long term, it all ends up as ruins or gets tipped into landfill sites, so I don't regard this as the Earth shrinking. But there is a way in which the Earth is shrinking. It's hot inside and is gradually cooling down as the radioactive heat supply decreases. Now, when solids cool down, they contract in size. It's called thermal contraction. So this very long-term cooling must result in the Earth shrinking a bit. We can see the effect of the planet shrinking through thermal contraction when we look at Mercury. That's the planet that I study. There are kilometre-high escarpments running across its surface called lobate scarps, which are where thrust faults reach the surface. You can think of them as like the wrinkles that form on, say, an apple when it dries out. The displacement across each thrust fault is typically 2 or 3 kilometres, and by mapping them out, we can work out that the whole planet has contracted in radius by about 7 kilometres in the past 3 billion years. Now, the Earth is probably cooling down a bit more slowly than Mercury because it's a bigger planet, but we'd still expect maybe about a kilometre of global contraction in the past billion years. Trouble is, we can't see this on the Earth's surface because, unlike Mercury, we have plate tectonics here. Plates are shifting around at speeds of centimetres a year, and new materials added at mid-ocean ridges and destroyed at major thrusts called subduction zones, where continents are pushed over oceans. As a result, active thrust faults on Earth take only about a million years to move by an amount that would take a billion years for a thrust fault on Mercury. Any signal of global contraction in the Earth's crust is completely swamped by the faster and greater movements caused by plate tectonics. There is a further line of thought that Gerald's question provoked in me, which is that material is being added to the solid Earth all the time. This comes in the form of meteorite debris arriving from space. Most of it's in the form of dust-sized micrometeorites rather than as big lumps. Most people don't notice this, but about 150 million kilograms is added to the Earth every year. Sounds like an awful lot, but if you spread it out over the 500 million square kilometres of the Earth's surface, that's well less than a kilogram per square kilometre per year. Now, by my calculations, it would take about a billion years to bury the ground in a 10 centimetre layer of meteoritic dust. So to sum up, I'd say that the Earth is very, very slowly shrinking and becoming denser as it does, and the rate of addition of new material from space is nowhere near enough to compensate for this in terms of maintaining its size.
Thanks to David Rothery and to Gerald for the question. And if you have a question for the team, remember you can contact the show on unexpected@bbc.co.uk or WhatsApp us on +44 330 678 3080, or you can write to us, Unexpected Elements, BBC World Service, Cardiff CF10 4GA.
It happened. I'm going to take my sunglasses off. Wow. Oh my gosh.
The solar eclipse has been all over the news this week.
People have got their phones out, and it's just amazing. You can see it's like a halo around the sun and the moon. They're aligned, and it's now moving through the clouds. And we're in total darkness. It is exactly how everyone has described it to me, who've seen it, which is that it's indescribable. You can see any, I don't know what you're seeing, if you're seeing that sun and moon moving, but I can tell you what's happening here on the ground in the park. Children just standing up in complete awe. This is an area where families have come for the night and for the day to watch this huge phenomenon, and people are clapping. It's thrilling. It's a really thrilling moment.
I love that we clapped a big lump of rock for orbiting. Christine, I just want to ask, did anyone clap where you were?
Nobody was clapping, but everyone had their arms up towards the sky during the eclipse. I guess it's a different way of acknowledging it.
But all of the eclipse hoo-ha made me think back to the news headline from the New York Times in 1919, so 100 and something years ago, 105 years ago, which ran: lights all askew in the heavens. Men of science more or less agog over results of eclipse observations. Einstein's theory triumphs. Stars not where they seemed or were calculated to be, but nobody need worry.
I love this headline.
It's great. It's back in the day when headlines just kind of were in little chunks that just went on and on and on. Chavi, Christine, have you heard the story of the eclipse that proved Einstein's theory?
No, it sounds amazing, especially from the headlines.
I know. I love that nobody need worry. Reassuring words. The stars aren't where they're supposed to be, but New York Times says don't worry about it. OK, let me share. It was 1919, and over on the African island of Principe, British astronomer Arthur Eddington was all set up for the eclipse. Only he wasn't really interested in the eclipse itself. He was interested in what else you could see once the sun was shaded by the path of the moon. Over 100 years later, on the BBC World Service, Science in Action presenter Roland Pease went down to an anniversary event at the Royal Astronomical Society to hear a talk from the same Arthur Eddington. Wait, what?
Well, he's not actually Arthur Eddington. He's actor Colin Utley, channeling the British astronomer who 100 years ago, 6 months after the end of the Great War, experimentally proved the theory of gravity developed by the German physicist Einstein. Let's keep listening.
Now, here on the Earth, the gravitational field is pretty weak, as I'm sure you'll understand. If we can find a body with a stronger gravitational force, then that could help us. So, the Sun, there's the first thing. 27,000 times the gravitational force of the Earth. So, what if some light from a distant object were to pass close to the Sun?
OK, so Eddington's getting close to explaining his 100-year-old observations, which have become one of the iconic tests of all science. For 4 years, the British astronomer had been in indirect contact with Einstein in Berlin via a Dutch intermediary, discussing the German's 1915 general theory of relativity. A key prediction of the theory was that light should follow a curved path if travelling close enough to a massive object. The Sun is massive enough, but of course, by day it outshines the light from any stars whose rays graze its surface. And that's why Eddington had fixated on an eclipse coming up on the 29th of May 1919, which could be seen from either side of the Atlantic, on Principe off the coast of Africa and at Sobral in Brazil. Eddington headed to Principe armed with telescopes and photographic plates to catch the event.
Eddington got lucky. The clouds parted and he took photographs. Back at the Royal Astronomical Society event, archivist Sean Prosser showed these same pictures and the details of bending light, or to give it its proper name, gravitational lensing, that could be measured on them.
These are some of the most important eclipse images ever taken. These are positive plates, lantern slides from our collection.
And these were produced by Eddington and his colleagues who also went to Brazil. These were produced from that expedition.
Yes, that's right. So we've got two lantern slides showing the eclipse as it was photographed by Crommelin and Davidson from Sobral in Brazil, and two images showing the eclipse as it was seen from the island of Principe, and that was photographed by Arthur Eddington and Edwin Cottingham.
I mean, it's extraordinary to think that all that blackness there, you've got to pick out, amongst all the bits where it's not developed quite properly, you've got to try and pick out starlight that's come from the other side of the sun. It looks like a pretty tough job.
A really tough job. It took weeks, if not months, for Eddington and his colleagues to measure the plates accurately, to calibrate them, to make sure that they'd taken as accurate an observation as possible so that they could prove the very small, I think it was 0.75 arc seconds of movement that was caused by the gravitational lensing, and they had to measure that so precisely, and it was only until they were really sure that they made the announcement on the 6th of November proving Einstein's theory of relativity.
So, to a stunned audience of scientists, on the evening of the 6th of November 1919, Eddington and colleagues presented their results, which overturned 200 years of Newtonian physics. Einstein's theory of gravitation, or general relativity, was confirmed, all thanks to an eclipse and a lot of hard work.
I would clap for that.
Yeah, exactly. Well done.
I would definitely put my arms up.
And our total orbit back to the subject of eclipses brings this episode of Unexpected Elements to an end. And on our transit, we've discovered that cowboys were black, that the banjo was African. Everything with a scientific Latin name might qualify for a different one. We've learnt how to dance about chemistry. We've learnt why hair is curly. There's some unexpected stuff in there. But that's us out of time. It just remains for me to thank this week's panel. In Mumbai, in India, we had Chavi Sachdev. Thank you very much, Chavi.
Mitello, Grong Taigen.
What language is that, Chavi?
Garo, which they speak in Meghalaya State.
And in Mexico, we have Christine Johannes. Thank you, Christine.
I'm Marnie Chesterton. The producer was Tom Bonnet, with Harrison Lewis, Alex Mansfield, Elliot Prince and Sol Whitney. Join us next week for more Unexpected Elements.